Join us at The Hedge for a conversation about engineering, technology, and business.
In this episode, Russ White, Tom Ammon, and Ed Horley dig into IPv6 deployment.
Hello again, Tom. Two times in one day, I don't know if I can handle it. And there's Ed, who turned his camera off because he didn't want to see us because he was not in a tuxedo. That's the problem.
Not in my daily wear.
he's feeling underdressed.
Every day I wear a tuxedo at home while I work from home. That's how it works.
That's it. I was actually in the 21st Air Force for a while, and we had a very secure facility into which you had to go into a door, which was a double door with firing ports through the sides of the chamber. So it was like a double door chamber. And you walk in, you push a little thing, a little intercom button, and a person on the end says, "Are you under duress?" So that if you are, you can just say yes, and the person who's trying to get you to break into the facility for them can't hear what's being said. So the person was a little bit under some alcoholic influence, and they heard, "Are you undressed?" and said, "Oh, I forgot my uniform. Yes, I'm undressed." And it was quite a circus for some period of time. So anyway, that's my weird security story for the day.
Well, I'm not that underdressed. I can't turn my camera on and not be embarrassed by that fact. So we're good to go.
All right, Ed, we're going to talk about V6. I mean, we're going down this rat hole, so let's just go down it.
Let's just start. I don't know why anyone would talk to IPv6 to me, of all people. I can't imagine where that would come from. So. But yeah, let's talk about V6, because I think, let's make declarations now. Like, so year 2020, is it going to be Linux on the desktop, or is it going to be IPv6? Which direction, or is Kubernetes just taking over the world and we don't have to talk about anything else?
Well, Linux on the desktop was like 2015 for me, so I guess V6 is the only choice.
Well, I meant wide mainstream adoption. How's that?
Okay. Yeah.
No, I don't think Linux on the desktop is coming anytime soon. So,
wow, V6 is beating something out. Look out,
Tom. Well, careful. Is mainstream the right word for V6?
Hey, well, let's talk about that. So what is mainstream? Is it like the fact that ubiquitously everyone is using it, but they don't know it? Is that considered mainstream? I don't know. Like, if you're on a T-Mobile handset in the United States, you're on V6. And if you're on an iPhone on T-Mobile, you're V6 only. So it's like, is that mainstream enough? I don't know.
when Docker containers stop using NAT. No, sorry.
Well, there's a lot of fix. You saw the recent announcement from Kubernetes, from KubeCon, right, Russ? That in terms of the V6, mainline V6 support for Kubernetes. So they got tired of the fact that they were doing that and a bunch of that. And so V6 seems to make a lot of sense for what they want to do going forward. So that made
I was in trouble with Kubernetes networking when I read a blog post, and the blog post said, "We looked at dynamic routing and decided it was too complex, so we designed something simpler."
Well, it's turtles the whole way down, right? NAT everywhere. If you have more ports, then make use of more ports.
It's pretty crazy. So I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I think that if everyone were running V6 and didn't know it, that's a pretty good sign. I think the other thing is if every presentation I saw had V6 only addresses in it, except when you had to do something V4, which there's actually an RFC about that now, I think.
I think there is for portions of that. I've been seeing an uptick among the major networking conferences, at least, and Cisco Live is inclusive of that, but some of the others too, about seeing a lot more example configurations that are inclusive of V6, and in some cases V6 only. Because the reality is that dual stack doesn't solve any problems for us, right? I mean, it makes it a little bit easier to adopt IPv6, but it doesn't actually solve the problem, right? You still have V4 hanging around, which is the part of the inherent issues. And so I've been seeing more and more presentations that are talking about V6 only. And I think, tip of the hat to Veronica McKillop over at Microsoft, in terms of getting out there and really talking about that structurally dual stack doesn't solve any problems for Microsoft. And they're rapidly trying to move to V6 only to really address their internal issues, structural internal issues that they're trying to solve for their corporate IT side, never even mind production with Azure and everything else that they're working on over there.
So when I look at V6, V4 in data center fabrics in particular, because I spend a lot of time in data centers now, it's weird because I started out primarily on the WAN side and frame relay and stuff. And now I seem to spend all of my days in data center fabrics. But anyway, that if you build your data center fabric right, you don't even need V4 on the underlay at all. In fact, you shouldn't run it on your underlay at all.
Yes. Yeah.
Your underlay should be V6, and V4 should just be just like your Ethernet.
It should just be a service on top. V4 is a service.
It should be just like a layer 2 service on top. You have IPv4 service on top and Ethernet service on top.
Yep. Yeah, I would agree. In fact, some of the customers that we're working with very much want to move to that topology and architecture. And there's a couple of reasons why. Number one, they don't have to, quote unquote, carve out specialty RFC 1980 address space that they have to keep track of in order to build fabric, right? So they have full isolation. They don't have to worry about that aspect of routing domain and boundaries of control and things like that. And in addition, they can run as many overlay, RFC 1918 conflicting address space on top of it as they want, depending on what their need requirements are internally. So if they have teams that made mistakes in terms of address allocations, they don't have to worry about it as much. So it becomes a really flexible tool for them. And then extensions into public cloud become even an additional discussion, because I think there's some really interesting things that are going on there. Because I have several customers today who are looking at deploying their V6 story is starting in public cloud. It's starting in AWS. And that's what they're using to actually do their interconnect and V6. And they're using that as a driver to bring changes of behavior back into their on-premise data center location for IPv6. But it was easier to actually start in AWS than it was to start within their own local local data center design.
No, that's very interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, one thing I think we still see a lot of V4 for, which kind of annoys me, is a lot of implementations of routing tables and just routing protocol stacks still require a V4 loopback address.
I don't know if I've seen that as much, but it's definitely there still. There's a bunch of things that are like that. There's some weird things I've seen recently with syslog for piping out for syslog too, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not really needed for anything. It's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. It's just an internal data structure problem that you still need that V4 address.
Like router IDs, right?
Right, exactly.
People using V4 quote unquote addresses for router IDs.
Yes.
Embedded in it's the same structural problem. But
exactly.
Realistically, if you read the RFC, they don't care whether it's dotted notation or just a number, as long as it's some sort of 32-bit number, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just got to be a unique 32-bit number.
Right.
My most recent run-in was I just came from working at a service provider, and on the Eyeball network, we're working, dealing with the same issues everybody's dealing with address exhaustion. And the thing that was really interesting to me was watching the evolution of business leadership on IPv6, because pretty quickly it went from, maybe one day, to, oh. And the big O moment was when it was time to go out on the market and get IPv4 addresses. And then it was like, wow, this is the, for service provider, especially an Eyeball network, this is the core of our business. And when you see the bill for a /16, then it's like, okay, maybe we should, it was really interesting to see that change from, no, that's just a toy, that's not real, to we should spend engineering cycles on this. And pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, I mean, how is that right now? I mean, is there, I know that a lot of IRs have dropped out of having V4 space, or at least a couple. How is the V4 space gray market or not gray market. It's not really gray market anymore.
No, it's all legal now.
It's all legal now.
Yeah.
So how is that going? I mean, are people making tons of money on it? Should I switch careers?
You should, but not into that one. that's a different discussion, Russ.
But well, I'm close enough to retirement that maybe that one's okay.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing that's going on there in terms of just sort of market forces is obviously the price per IP is been steadily climbing over the last few years. I think it's, you know, in the range of $18 to $20 an IP. So depending on what you're doing, that can be a pretty expensive acquisition. It may not be as expensive for the cloud providers, but at the same time, they're buying a much higher quantities than maybe others are buying in the marketplace. It's not unusual for them to pick up, you know, multiple slash 16s, maybe slash 12s, maybe slash, you know, bigger slash 9s, slash 10s, things like that. And so in the V4 landscape, that can be pretty expensive. You're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars to acquire address space, which is just a logical identity to hand out for someone to use, which seems like an odd thing to spend money on when you can spend money on getting someone to develop and write software for, you know, a new service or to go acquire more customers. And so V6 really helps address that particular side of the problem. And obviously, every single connection that happens on V6 doesn't happen on V4. That's the other thing that people seem to forget, is that if you do turn on V6 and you flip that traffic, that's not a session that's happening on V4. Now, it doesn't mean that you get to reclaim your V4 address space, because you may still need it for time being, but it may reduce the overall impact or load that is required on the V4 side of the network. But it doesn't change the characteristics of the fact that you're going to get some advantages out of adopting V6, and the pricing advantage is pretty profound, as Tom mentioned. I mean, it's, you know, for bigger cloud provider, someone like, you know, an Amazon or an Azure or, you know, Google even acquiring address space, or, you know, Alibaba, you know, for them, that's, you know, that's just part of their business model. So even though it may be $20 an IP that they have to go out and spend, remember, they're renting it to you for, you know, $5 a month.
Right.
They make their money back. They make their money back in the first year if you don't release it back to the general pool. So the reality is that assuming that they continue with their business model as is, it's not a huge encumbrance for them. For the rest of the market to try and compete with them on price to acquire that address space becomes a much bigger issue. So if you're an enterprise or a smaller cloud provider who's trying to compete to be able to get that address space, you have two sets of problems. Number one, can you get the address space? Number two, is it clean? Like,
is it in a Bogon list someplace?
Yeah, the reputation.
But to dump spam.
Yeah, it's a huge problem for V4 address space. And so you're actually better off starting with clean V6 address space that's never been used before and getting conversion over to that, probably, than trying to find clean V4 address space. Because you're going to pay more per address for clean address space versus unclean address space. And then I don't know if everyone saw the weird announcements about the U.S. government is going to, you know, they're trying to release through some of their V4 address space from some well-known address allocations for military and government that everyone else considered like off list and put on Bogon. You should never see anything out of this address space. And suddenly they're like, no, we might actually give that up. And it may be out on the general internet again, and everyone's going to be scrambling trying to fix their, we used, you know, 5.0 internally or, you know, whatever address space was supposed to be reserved. They never were supposed to use it. And they went out and used it because of the fact that they thought, you know, that this U.S. government entity would never hand it back, right? So there's a bunch of use cases. Yeah, there's a bunch of use. It's clean address space, but it's still on the Bogon list because you were never supposed to see it.
So how many governments could reduce their debt significantly, their national debt significantly, by selling off their V4 address?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's going to make it on the list. I think we're so far down that hole that there's no amount of address space that we can give up. And no matter what the price point, So I just think the V6, the thing that's unknown for many people on the V6 address space is really just the sort of subversive nature of what's been happening over the last 10 years. I always laugh when people say, like, you know, V6, it's been around for 20, 25 years, and why hasn't it been adopted? And I'm like, no, they wrote the standard that long ago. But if you look at the mainstream adoption, like people actually trying to get it implemented at any scale or level, nothing really started until probably what? 2010. I think like the first time you really started seeing people talking about it that way was a Google Implementers event. That was 2009, 2010 that those were going on. I think.
Well, 2011. we tend to forget that IPv4 took that long.
Yeah. No, it took deploy. It took just as long to deploy in terms of widespread ubiquitous use.
Right.
It really didn't hit the hockey stick in terms of usage until mid to late 90s in terms of like the consumption rate for people to really get on board and adopt it. And if you look at it that way, that's when everyone realized that we were going to run out.
Yeah.
But like, there's a run, right?
Yeah, I remember when I was working as an operator in several networks, one of which was a U.S. military network, and it was all IPX and VIP, if anybody even knows what VIP is any longer. But anyway, it was all IPX and VIP. And, you know, it was a big deal when we started turning on IPv4, and people were trying to figure out, what do you do with this, right? You can't get to any services with it because everything's running VIP or IPX in service terms. You can telnet with it, but what do you telnet into? I mean, who really cares? And then I was working for a large chemical company for a while, and they were all Novell, so they were strictly IPX on the entire network. And the VP was standing in some meeting one day. One of the VPs was standing, and he said, somebody asked him about IP, and he said, well, I'm certain that our networking people have it set up so that if we need IP tomorrow, we could turn it on like tap water. And people don't realize, I mean, this is not that long ago, okay?
Yeah,
okay, either that or I'm really old. One or the other.
Well, that's both, but that's a different story altogether. I think the important thing for people to realize is, and the thing that I think always throws everyone off a little bit is the fact that all the operating systems have it on by default and preferred. And so the moment your network team starts to try and play around with turning on IPv6, they don't realize what operational impact they're having within the rest of the organization. So the planning side is really important to get out of the way, because if you don't do it right, and you don't actually have, you know, end-to-end public V6 internet access, you're going to cause all sorts of, you know, delays and hiccups and other weird, interesting sort of problems within your network as you get going, which is why, you know, having some sort of strategy, at least working on the strategy portion of it within 2020, I think there's a lot of companies that are going to start scratching their head and saying, is this something we at least need to have a strategy and have an understanding and start training up and figuring out what resources we need and where things need to go? Because, you know, the service providers are done, the backbones are done, at least for the core portions of the internet. All the mobile providers are done, the content providers are done, the cloud providers are pretty much done. And everyone at home from a broadcast, you know, from a broadband perspective is ready to go. You know, Comcast has got their deployments going, you know, Cox and a bunch of the others are well on their way. So you sort of scratch your head and say, what's left over? And it's enterprise. It's enterprise deployments that are left over that are all sitting on the sidelines and saying basically, well, we don't have to worry about this. And I think to a certain degree, they're right. Right, they're correct in the fact that they don't have to worry about it. They've got V4, and probably if they're in North America or in, you know, Western Europe, they're sitting on plenty of V4 address space, enough to support their organization for whatever time period they need. The service providers all moved because they realized they didn't have anything left to sell unless they have addresses, right? Unless you have an address to actually hand to a customer, you can't get them on the network. It's a little hard to have a business model. But for enterprises, they're like, well, we just need to consume content, right? We're principally probably a consumer of content, either from cloud or from, you know, other SaaS services, or just interconnecting and talking to our peers. The problem for them is what's going on in the rest of the world. So if you're an enterprise Fortune 1000 shop, how do you talk to the rest of the world when they don't have what we had starting off early with the internet, which is a ubiquitous amount of IPv4? So if you're dealing with India and they don't have V4 to hand out, guess what? They're not going to build their network with V4 because they don't have any V4. They're going to build it on V6, which is exactly what happened for, you know, in terms of a major mobile provider over there. So the reason that you see some of the graphs for, you know, V6 adoption, if you go look at Akamai's or Google's or others, you know, India shot up to the number one slot position, like something like 60-65%, depending on what day you look at the graphs of IPv6, native IPv6 adoption happening in the country. And it's because of two mobile providers, right?
So Ed, you mentioned that you work with enterprise customers. Is there any kind of a common thread you've seen throughout this last year, 2019, of, you know, why they are starting to focus on it, why they're calling you up and paying you dollars for it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. The first is there's some unique use cases you can do. I mentioned it earlier when we're talking about using cloud to be able to get to V6. When you have mergers and acquisitions going on a regular basis and you're a larger company, one of the most painful processes you go through is actually resolving conflicting address space to actually get services to operate within a large distributed environment. We see more and more of the larger companies actually not even merge their networks and tell their acquired companies to continue to operate separately on public services because it's so hard to actually merge them in. Yep. And this runs counter to the actual business use cases that were argumented or articulated to actually acquire the company, where they quote unquote got to utilize shared resources that the corporate company, the big, big A, B, or C company that's acquiring, saying, well, you get to make use of all our leveraged agreements, our data center, our cheap cost of circuits that we've negotiated, our low cost internet bandwidth, our, XYZ. And none of that can get integrated in because they have so much overlapping address space that it functionally makes it an unusable network for them to integrate in. And they certainly can't do it in the time frame that the finance team specified. So what the network team does is hits the easy button and says, just continue to operate what you're doing and we'll provide you a VPN service or we're just going to tie you to a public cloud and that's it. That's how we're going to interface with you. And what becomes interesting is that if the business folks come back and say, like, that doesn't work for our business model, like, we can't continue to pay for the data center over the next 3 years. It was part of the acquisition strategy was to consolidate them. They're like, okay, we might be able to move them into our data center, but we still can't merge the networks together. So they're still going to continue to operate, have all the problems that go on there. And so what they're looking at is saying, you know what, we can use V6, it's globally unique. We know we're never going to have a conflict. We will migrate their services into our data center, but we'll only V6 enable them. Right? If you can sort of see where I'm going. Then we'll hand you an allocation to V6 to run on your network. And then when you come in and access resources, you're doing V6 to V6 and we leave your V4 alone. We never even touch it. We don't want to see your V4. We're not interested in your V4. You can use your traditional V4, internet default gateway. But when you talk to the rest of the world, you're going to talk via V6. Your services will come to us. Then we can route you to our public cloud provider. We can route you to Office 365 or G Suite. We can do all the content controls. We can map you out from a firewall-based permissions really easily. And you can get to all the services that we operate in our data center that runs on, that happens to be dual stack, but you're going to access over V6. So it becomes a very clear strategy, pretty easy to move that way. And it allows them to not have to deal with that NAT human resource problem of like readdressing networks over and over. Because we've worked with a handful of customers now who in 1 year acquired 8 companies with all of them with probably 10 or more site locations that probably 60, 65% of them were overlapping address ranges across the board. You can just imagine the capital resource problem of trying to get enough network engineers in the room together to try and turn this into a clean routing domain. It wouldn't work. And so they were like, we have to have a different strategy to do that. And so that's a really interesting one. The public cloud becoming the point that they can use to pivot to do that has been the second part of that story. And you could do that in your own data center or you can choose to do it in the public cloud and saying like AWS is where we're going to run our resources. We're going to dual stack it there. We're going to hand you a V6 allocation. We're going to bring you in over Direct Connect. And it's really easy. We just write a rule that basically says we'll only take your V6 traffic, right? And it becomes a really easy, clean way to sort of handle that. And it's easy to spin services out again because you're handing them an address range that hopefully, they can walk away with. So if you need to divest for any given reason, it also becomes easier to divest resources, assuming you get a large enough allocation and plan in advance. And that's been the interesting part. The second part is obviously working with companies that have international footprints and literally can't get address space in some of the countries they're dealing with. And like, what do you do then? Like, do you just assign out of your US address allocation and say, like, this is what you use over in XYZ country? And does that work from a routing topology basis? Well, we all know how service providers work. V4 is pretty sloppy that way, but V6 is a little bit cleaner. And so that helps solve some of those problems too. And they're realizing that their end users are coming in and they have V6 at home, right? And like, if they don't provide things like VPN services, they may end up with someone like on a T-Mobile handset who's trying to VPN in, right, for some sort of service. And guess what? They don't have a VPN, IPv6 VPN termination endpoint on the other side. Well, you know, all the NAT 64, DNS 64 in the world isn't going to solve that VPN problem for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So those are the sorts of things that we're starting to see. It's, I wouldn't say the commercial companies are really sort of, you know, those mid-sized companies are running into these issues, but the much bigger enterprise companies are starting to realize this is a problem. And then there's regulation stuff that's going on too. So like Bank of China, I don't know if you guys are familiar with some of the financial requirements, but the Bank of China is now putting requirements in for talking to them via V6 as a mandate. And that the top three applications that anyone develops from a banking standpoint that has to work or interact with them has to support IPv6, one of the top three that they're operating. So we're getting a lot of phone calls that are like, oh, we have this as a requirement. What do we have to do in order to be able to support that? So I think those are the sorts of things that are going to start structurally changing. There's some things with the National Science Foundation. So Rush, you might find this interesting. So the National Science Foundation, for when you want to apply for a grant that's doing research in you know, sort of computer, you know, IT-centric space, one of the requirements that they're putting in place is saying that you actually have to make that data available out to the, you know, Internet 2 and IPv6. So you're going to have to extend some sort of V6 access in order to get access to that data that you're sharing out for that NSF grant. So they're starting to write that into the grant proposals and saying like, hey, if you want to comply with this, well, there are a lot of universities out there that have billions of dollars they get a year from NSF. If you even know only a portion of those are in jeopardy due to the fact that you don't have V6, you start getting a lot more interest
right.
in that particular yeah. category. So I think those are the drivers that are happening in, you know, in the immediate term. There's no, you know, the service providers pretty much have this down. Like there's nothing left for them to really worry about because they're just transport, right? And so like, this was easy. It wasn't easy, but it was easy enough for them to get it done. I think the enterprises are looking at this and going like, we don't know anything about it. It's a big foreign thing for us. So how do we tackle this? How do we deal with it? How do we come up with a transition plan?
Now you said earlier there were some challenges for people who are just trying it, playing with it. So what types of things you're saying that if you turn it on your routers, it suddenly starts working anyway, just because all the hosts already have it. So are there any other things like this that, I mean, I would think security immediately comes to mind.
Yeah. Like obviously security is a big deal. Like you don't want to ignore security from just a general category overall, because it's key critical. But I think the reality is there's a comfort level for everyone on V4 from a network engineering skill set. Let's talk network engineering skills as opposed to just IT in general. I think for network engineers, sort of we've naturally always glued together where we've done network address translation with stateful packet inspection. It's been on the firewall. We do both the services at the same time. It becomes an easy, clean sort of demarcation or boundary location. It's also where our routing topologies will change, right? Because you're not going to leak out RFC 1918 space out to your public internet. They're not going to accept it anyway, but you wouldn't take it back in either, right? So it's sort of a natural location to do those things. With V6, because we're running global unicast addresses, it gets a little weird. You're like, wait a second, I'm running global address space on the inside of my network. Does that mean these things are all available in the same way out to the public internet? People start getting nervous, right? They start questioning like, well, wait a second, I don't understand. And this is where an address plan and, you know, understanding stateful packet inspection is different than network address translation, and like the fundamentals are really important to be able to make sure that people understand how to do that and how to tackle that. And then I guess the other thing would really be on the security side, understanding the nuances or differences in terms of like how addresses are allocated. And I know, Russ, you sat in many ITF meeting where you probably heard people screaming at each other around, you know, Slack versus DHCP V6 and what's important.
Oh, yes, of course.
but those are operational issues that are very important for the enterprise to understand what's going on. And there are nuances that happen with that that aren't as obvious for many people in terms of like making
right.
reservations right. for DHCP V6, right?
That's right. And things like if a regulator comes to you and says, I need to know who sent this email, or I need to know who sent this packet, which device emitted this packet, and you're on Slack, mm-hmm. you may not have that, you know, you just may not have that information.
If you didn't put the right measures in place to be able to log and track, or you don't have the right identity information stored,
yeah.
you're going to have some challenges. I don't think that's super unique, but it's definitely a bigger challenge for many. I think actually for lawful intercept, V6 is easier than V4 because if if you're on a, at least for service providers, because for service providers, if you were running carrier grade NAT, you were having to log everything at every location, you know, CPE where NAT might be happening, internally at your CGM where NAT's happening. And then you have to do it per flow, per timestamp for everything that's going on within your network. And you have to keep that data for however many time for lawful intercept is required. That's a lot of data that you're having to keep. If you're doing V6 with a global address, you just need to know where the prefix exists and say that's that homeowner, someone from their home logged in. I don't get to control that, but at least I know that's where it exists from a CPE basis. They have that global unique address, and that's what flows all the way end to end. I only have to log it once, right? I just have to see where
exactly
it goes to my network, and it's super simple. I get to match it one for one. If I were like in finance and in payment, this is the first thing I do. I go get a whole allocation just for doing payment processing and only use it for that purpose. Like go out and get a freaking 32 and be like, that. I'm just going to, every payment transaction I ever do with any system, like I'm PayPal or I'm Visa, like I'll just build a whole system that just hands out, you know, /64s for all my distributed finance systems. And every single time I just build, I spin up a unique address for that transaction, never reuse it again. People are like, you're crazy. Like, there's no way you could do that. But then you just have to sit down and do the math, and it actually totally works. You could burn through 64s and totally do that. Because like from an application basis, like I do this math with some of the students when I'm doing training, where we talk about like Kubernetes and like spinning up applications. And you're like, okay, let's spin up 10 million applications a second. I doubt most Kubernetes cluster or pods could ever do that, right? Like 10 million apps a second. I doubt you could pre-allocate the table fast enough and use 10 million, discard them. 1 second later, another 10 million, discard them, right? Just keep going. I mean, how long would it take you to burn through a /64? And so you sit down and you start doing all the math together, right? To figure it out. It's going to take you about 58,000 years to burn through a /64. And I'm like, how many people think their data center is going to be here in 1,000 years?
Well, I won't be here to care.
Right. Do you think your data center is going to be here in 100 years? Right? Like most folks, like, no, you're going to move on. 58,000 years, I think we're okay. So if you think about, you know, 10 million transactions a second, you could hand out a global unique address every single time. That's certainly supportable and doable for many of the financial institutions in terms of what they're up to. Because yeah, they'll burn through a 64 faster than that. But if you hand them a /32, it's going to take them a long time to burn through a /32 of /64s to chew up all those transactions. And so stuff like that becomes very interesting. Those are use cases. I'm not saying they're super valid for most enterprises or anything like that, but they're sort of interesting use cases to sort of noodle around and do math with, which is sort of fun.
Well, I mean, another interesting use case for V6 and enterprise would be just using host addresses to do traffic engineering.
Yes, you can absolutely host, do that.
Yep. Right, because each host has a /64. So in reality, the host could put, you could reach the host a /64 different ways across the network, mm-hmm. and it's still the same host, but every one of those /64, every one of those /128s or whatever is a different path through the network. Now, mm-hmm. you know, you're eating table space in your routing table, right?
Yeah.
But as a way of, a poor man's way of doing traffic engineering, it's really not necessarily use cases.
Yeah, it's
are
like
very
poor
narrow.
Man's segment routing, but
yeah, it is, right? But if your use cases are small enough in your network, hey.
Well, you know? What's interesting is you could actually stitch it together with segment routing, because if you were doing, if you were doing some sort of NFV, and you didn't have a control plane that actually worked on the host, you could sort of stitch that together to do the same sort of, if you didn't have something to do traffic engineering and application control on the host, you could do the same sort of thing. So that could be that's one of those sort of go down a rat hole that probably shouldn't happen from an engineering basis, but it's quite possible to do. Yeah,
probably. Well, have you looked at PPR? Have you looked at preferred path routing? Because it's using host bits within the /64 to do lots of interesting things.
No. Okay. So they're doing like mapping for like, they're putting like metadata in the last 64 in order to give it like characteristics for traffic steering and engineering. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. So it's a very interesting concept. Now, you know, again, you eat table space and blah, blah, blah. So there's a trade-off.
But if it's all distributed down to the edge, then, you know, it's not as bad as people think.
Right.
And there's something similar. What is it? Inband OEM?
Right.
That Frank Brontner's, that's pretty similar in terms of being able to sign the packet payload as it moves through, so you can guarantee any network function virtualization actually happened. Like, you can guarantee in the path flow that it actually went to the right location, that it did its thing, that it signed and moved on, and then you actually get a replay record provided at the end that you can just strip off from an extension header basis. You can just say, oh, that's great, it went through and did the right path. If it doesn't have the right extension headers with the right signing characteristics, you just discard it at the other end because it didn't go through the right path. And so it sort of guarantees that you have the right flows happening hop by hop throughout the network, which is completely impossible in V4 unless we were doing like weird... I don't know of any way that you could do it in V4 outside of doing something sort of out of band that says that, hey, that packet's bad. This is literally in band as part of the characteristic of the packet payload itself, which is sort of unique.
If I were to set up a V6 only website, what percentage of the internet could reach it today?
That's an interesting question. I think it obviously depends on where you are in the world. So if you're dealing with, and also who the audience is. So if you're dealing with it on a mobile application basis and you're in India, 60% of the population is going to be able to hit your site. Here in domestic US, same mobile network, it's probably going to be much higher because the mobile providers are pretty much all have, they're like, I think 80% or above on V6 adoption. So you're going to pretty much guarantee that you're available there. If you're on a home side of the network, so Comcast at home, you're probably good. Cox, I don't know, 70% of them. If you're sitting at an enterprise, no one's going to see you unless you're at Facebook or unless you're at Google or unless you're at Microsoft or one of the big boys that has already deployed V6 internally, Boeing, for instance, a few others. But outside of that, they're not going to be able to see your site unless they're going through NAT64, DNS64, or the service provider is providing some sort of translation service, or your CDN. Now, if your CDN enabled, then it doesn't matter because they'll do V6 and V4 for you, and they'll handle that translation. But if you're just standing it up on your own V6 only, you're going to have that sort of split based off of the demographics. And that's the challenge that's going on today, is the Fortune can't see you. The Fortune 1000 can't see you, but pretty much everyone else can. That's the funny thing about it, right? So they're off in this island that they literally can't see or talk to resources. There is a good chunk of academia and probably a good portion of federal and state agencies that won't be able to see you, and local city agencies fit in that category too, where they're going to struggle in that particular area. Some of the bigger U.S. government federal networks are really starting to take off. Their IRS, strangely enough, you can get your taxes in with V6. They make sure that they can talk to you, so that's not a problem. So that's the I don't know if that's a plus. I guess that's a plus. They pay for all. You're talking to a guy who has a formal civil engineering background and education, and so I believe in paying for infrastructure. So pay for roads, sewage systems,
it's
water, clean air, all that. So our government takes care of that. That's something we should pay taxes for. But that's the sort of stuff you're going to see. I mean, if it's you and me just setting up a quick website and we want to try and attract business, it'll be a mixed bag. It'll probably be 50% or greater that they can see your site.
So do you see anybody actively dismantling their IPv4 infrastructure?
Well, I'm public on record trying to remove V4 from their net. I'd say Microsoft is the most vocal about where they want to go in regards to this. I think the other one that people don't realize is that, Facebook doesn't even bother to run V4 in their data center. That's an interesting one. LinkedIn is in a similar category. Russ can probably talk a little bit about that if he wants. But that's a unique use case where they're like, we don't want to run two protocols operationally. It's too difficult. It makes no sense. So we're just going to run V6. We're going to run V4 as a service on top, and that solves that problem. And Facebook.
Oh, even more than that.
Yeah.
You can terminate the V4 session at the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And on your web server, and you don't need like any V4 because you can just run all your internal services. I mean, single application fabrics are much easier to convert to V6 only. Because
you control the whole thing.
I can do everything I want to internally, and it doesn't even matter. It's like when I was at LinkedIn and we were talking about going to SSL for everything on the data center fabric.
Yeah.
And like, it's really, you just turn it on as long as the applications and the hosts support it.
Right.
There's really not a whole lot there.
Yeah, that's a similar sorts of stories. I think the challenges for V6 for the enterprise, I'd say the common ones that I'm seeing now are more and more of the enterprises that are interested in doing some sort of form of work around zero-touch provisioning. I think that's still a little bit hard in V6 versus V4, mainly because V4 is completely insecure in its zero-touch provisioning side. How that works, that's a different discussion. You just have to trust the resource. If it's available on the network, just trust it and suck down your config and it's all good. but on V6, it's equally as hard. It's just because of sort of the DHCP V6 and the option codes and what's supported in firmware for the NICs and things like that. So if you're trying to build, you know, sort of data center at scale, but not quite massive cloud scale like Amazon and Azure and Alibaba and Google, and you're that next tier down, and I don't know if LinkedIn fits in that or not, but you know, sort of the not quite massive scale, but big enough scale, then these things start to turn into like painful processes where you have to code around a few things, stuff like that.
Yeah.
For most enterprises, I still see, amazingly enough, most enterprises, they're still sort of handcrafting their turnip and provisioning of services within their data center. I don't know if you found that too, Russ, from discussions with customers and things.
Yeah. I mean, we're still in that mode where every physical device, every physical appliance is a little special device that sits over in the corner and we give it
all
a name.
Snowflakes. Yeah.
And every service is, you know, it's like going to your local barista bar and getting that specialized coffee, only they're actually more commodity focused than most networks are.
Yeah, that's funny. I don't know, Tom, if you have a similar experience, but that's been my experience. At least that's my narrow lens or view of sort of where things are at. I mean, whether that's fair or not is a totally different discussion.
Well, it's not about fairness. It's about reality.
Yeah. Well, I think the enterprise has some interesting challenges, like you sort of mentioned, that other people who have deployed this don't have. So I think enterprises sort of get this, they're enterprise, they're in the Stone Age around everything, they're always be lagging behind, they have the dumbest people, blah, blah, blah. You hear these sorts, you know, the integration challenges, the interconnection challenges they have. They have, you know, a bunch of vendors who are providing stuff to them who are just not going to do some of the stuff you want them to do, like V6. You know, they have all these different requirements. You go to a service provider. I've been there. Yeah, all you got to do is provide a transport network. That's actually not that hard to turn up. You go to LinkedIn. Sure, they own the entire infrastructure. An executive can say to everybody, we're doing this, and they do it. Roll into a Fortune 500, and you're like, hey, how can we get something done everywhere in this whole entire company?
Yeah, I have 500 business owners who all run their application, who all consider it the most important app they've ever had because, well, that's how they're paid and bonused, right? My service has to stay up or I can't pay people payroll. No one wants to mess with that system, right? Like, you don't want to be known as the guy that brought the payroll system. No one got to check that week. That's the worst job ever. So I think those are the sorts of things that enterprises deal with that's very hard. And they're supporting systems that are sometimes incredibly old. I mean, like, even the payment processing systems that I've had, you know, that I've gone and seen, I'm amazed how, you know, some are still running on mainframe systems and older. It's very hard to transition and change that if you're running real-time business operating systems on them that are supporting, you know, billions of dollars happening, and that's what you're reporting to the street. And they're like, yeah, we're going to rip all our guts out and replace it, you know, overnight. Don't worry. Switch off, you know, tonight and tomorrow morning, all the transactions will still be happening. What's, you know, good luck on that pitch. And I think for many enterprises, they see V6 that way. They don't realize that they can migrate in a more elegant manner to be able to adopt it and have a much easier transition. And so the scariness factor of everything else on your plate, right? If you're an enterprise architect and you're being told you've got to automate and move to cloud and adopt all these great new fabric designs for running in your data center. And by the way, you've got all of this new edge transport work and security work and et cetera, et cetera. And then you just bring V6. It's half the time that's a needle that broke the camel's back sort of thing, or whatever you want to call it. Cause it's not that difficult, at least in my opinion. I guess I've been doing it enough that it's not that difficult for many people to grasp. And good network engineers, when we're working with them, rarely have an issue understanding V6. Like, the routing is the same, the address space, once they get comfortable with it, the prefix allocation portion, once they get a handle on that, it's everyone else. It's like turning to everyone else and saying, by the way, you have to test your application, make sure your app actually works.
Yeah.
We have to go through and make sure that all the firewall logging is still going to work and that you can actually identify this stuff. Oh, by the way, does your identity access stuff work. Those are all the challenges that through the list that are much harder than the actual networking portion. Like,
yeah, does your AS400 front end processor support V6?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things on the list, and it's sort of like, okay, well, we can start isolating those. We'll make those V6 only domains or boundaries, and these are V4 only domains and boundaries, and here's where you dual stack, and then you're like, then you have to go down the discussion of like, how do I build translation services, right? Do I have to provide this to V6 only client? I think the way that most people start in enterprise that I've seen is get an internet edge turned up, get VPN services enabled, start lighting up their guest net to just get the basic services going, and then start talking about integration for data center because they want to turn the services up. And then they start talking about, okay, that's when we need to put V6 on the roadmap for our app team and our security team and others. And that gives them time to digest it over the next 3 to 5 years, right? We're going to slowly work our way through as the app refresh cycle, as the requirements for, you know, procurement. First thing you do is you write a procurement policy that says, hey, your app has to support V6 and has to support V6 only. The reality is that it doesn't do you any good. If there's any dependency on V4 at all and you try and move to V6 only, you're not in a good state. You're in the same state as being on a V4 only network. So you have to be able to test for V6 only and you have to be able to support it there. Once those things happen, things will slowly start moving forward, and it doesn't have to be an overnight. You don't have to land on the other side and burn the boat. I'd love it if more people did that, but you know, even companies as big as Microsoft that want to get there as quickly as possible, you see them struggling around many of these services and applications that they have to support. And these are folks that are literally writing the code, right, in the operating systems. And if they're struggling around it, you can't expect everyone to be able to do it overnight.
So I think we'll cap it there. I'm getting tired. No.
V6 makes you tired? Makes me tired.
Yes. But you do it for a living and I don't. So, you know, that's okay.
Well, you indirectly do it for a living.
Yeah. Well, something like that. So, Tom, Twitter and LinkedIn, right?
Yep. Those are the places.
And that's it. And Ed, do you still have your show on Packet Pushers?
Yeah, I do the IPv6 buzz on Packet Pushers, so you can check that out if you want to hear myself and you know Scott Hogue and Tom Cuffey.
Right.
So they're my co-hosts on the IPv6 buzz. We gab about V6 and just talk about it and have guests on to talk about V6 and what's going on. So that's our sort of main gabbing spot for doing that. But yeah, you can check it out. I'm also on Twitter at eHorley on Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn. I think it's like /in/eHorley. I think I got one of the easy ones because my name's unique enough.
And no blog, right?
I have a blog. I have howfunky.com because, you know, how funky is your chicken? So it's got a chicken on there. So it's howfunky.com. I've had that for ages, 2005 or something? Yeah. So I have blog content up there for when I'm doing stuff with like Network Field Day and Tech Field Day and things of that nature. I'll post up there occasionally for a few musings. If you want to hear my V6 blog stuff, that's all up on Infoblox, the IPv6 Center of Excellence at Infoblox. I blog post up there and put content up there. So okay. I'm out there. You can find me.
Excellent. Very, very good. Thanks for coming on the Hedge, Ed.
Yeah.
And thanks. We'll get you next time. We'll bring you back on to talk about something other than V6.
Yeah, we should talk about cloud networking. That's always fun.
Oh, yes. All right.
Blow that one up.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. You can find The Hedge at rule11.tech.